Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
Hi, welcome to this week's edition of the Nation Podcast, where once again we'll be talking about gun control. I'm George Zornick, the Washington reporter with the Nation Magazine.
And hi, I'm Bryce Covert, a blogger with The Nation, and we are joined by Julianne Hing of Color Lines, and we'll be talking about the gun control agenda as well as how that may lead into some other issues for people of color. But given that there's been so much news in the past couple days, very concrete news on gun control, I would love to have you, George, sort of start us out by giving us a lay of the land. You know, what was all that stuff that Obama just proposed, and what is the outlook for all of it? There was a lot in there.
Yeah, I think as most people may know, Obama had a pretty strong opening gambit on gun control yesterday, on Thursday. Wednesday. He mentioned when he was running for president in 2008, he said that he was in favor of the assault weapons ban, but didn't devote a whole ton of time to it. For the first 4 years of his presidency, even after terrible mass shootings, he didn't say one word, literally one word, about the assault weapons ban until towards the very end. So I think expectations among gun control folks and progressives in general were pretty low, at least in the first couple of days after Newtown. But he came out yesterday with what I think everyone on the left side of the spectrum believes is at least stronger than what they expected. And there are some hitches and some problems to what he proposed, which I'm looking forward to getting into with you guys. But on the top line, you know, he directly took on the NRA. He called them out for kind of negatively influencing Congress with their money. He called for a very strong assault weapons ban, stronger than what was passed in 1994. He called for banning high-capacity magazine clips, anything under or rather over 10 bullets. He called for a universal background check system. Right now, about 40% of the guns that are sold in the country fall under the so-called gun show loophole, where they're sold between private sellers at a gun show or otherwise, and thus not subject to a background check. That's much more of a broad exemption than a loophole. And so he'd like to close that. He'd like to apply pretty much every gun transfer in the United States to a background check, unless it's, you know, very narrowly defined as between two immediate family members or basically someone lending their friend a shotgun to go hunting. But other than that, it's all going to be subject to a background check. And a host of other kind of smaller administrative things, which people can check out at thenation.com. We kind of laid it all out, and I won't waste time describing all of them, but they involve appointing a permanent head to the ATF and a bunch of executive orders on enforcement and mental health care, which I'm sure we'll get into soon. So it was a strong opening gambit, and one that I think will be well received in Congress, except for the top line item of the assault weapons ban. You've already seen, and we've been chronicling, a lot of top Democrats kind of edging away from that and saying, well, we know that's dangerous. We know that can't pass. They are kind of wary of the political fallout of actually banning guns, or a certain type of gun even. And so there's some people like Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer and Mike Thompson, who's leading the House effort on gun violence for Democrats, and even people like Al Franken, who are kind of preemptively surrendering on the assault weapons ban and saying, let's not waste too much time talking about that. Republicans at least ostensibly agree with universal background checks. Let's focus on what we can get and see if we can actually pass something for once. So that's where it stands now.
Right. It's interesting and perhaps a little disheartening to see the Democrats already starting to distance themselves. I think you, as you wrote, progressives are disappointed mostly because it's the same old sort of giving up ground before you've even entered a negotiation. And what's weird, too, is that the public actually seems to be in pretty strong support of a lot of these things, even the assault weapons ban, perhaps not as much strong support as for background checks, but the polls are actually looking pretty good. Is this just like leftover paranoia from the 90s message that if you're a Democrat and you talk about gun control, you'll lose? Are these people, I know Al Franken's up for re-election, is it just like hedging and trying to be very cautious?
Yeah, I think it's all of that. I think they're kind of overestimating what the political fallout from the 94 assault weapons ban was. But they are certainly scared, particularly folks like Al Franken. You know, he's a strong liberal, and Minnesota is a purplish to blue state, but it's fairly rural. I mean, they have a lot of hunters there. And so I think they're scared of really putting themselves out on the line. Like, look, I think they understand the dynamic that if they put the assault weapons ban on the table, you know, it is popular. It's got 58% of the people backing it. That's not huge, but it's big. I think they understand that if they put it on the table, they can force Republicans into a bad vote and ultimately get a better gun control package. I don't think they're naive about that. I think they would instead rather just avoid taking the vote. And so they're trying to kill this before it even comes to the table, which I understand the logic to, but I agree is disheartening.
Right. Particularly because this is a moment we haven't seen in a long time. I don't think I've seen this kind of action since I was a teenager, at least on gun control. It feels kind of historic. So it would be sad to miss this moment, I would think.
It really would.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the last time this was discussed in 94, I was 11 years old. I mean, it just hasn't been, and the Democratic establishment has completely left this alone. Even as recent as 2006, they were actively, Rahm Emanuel was actively recruiting pro-gun Democrats to run in House races. I know when I worked at the Center for American Progress, we had very wide leeway on things, but I don't think it's a secret that both the death penalty and gun control were things that, you know, people just kind of shied away from because the determination made by Democrats was the politics on this are unwinnable and terrible, and, you know, we're only hurting ourselves by talking about it. I think a lot of these mass shootings have changed that, but I don't think that the transformation is complete.
Right. It is interesting to see that CAP came out with a huge proposal on gun control, so they have taken hold of that, the reins of that, I guess, and, you know, I don't know if that is another signal that momentum is in that direction, but I think it's probably a good sign. Do you think that there's chance that Congress could focus on something like background checks and pay less attention to an assault weapons ban to at least do something?
Yeah, I think that's basically where it's going. Dianne Feinstein is going to put forward a strong assault weapons ban. It's just a question of, is Harry Reid going to let it come up for a vote? I'm guessing he will. I don't think he can cut her legs out quite that severely, but he probably won't push for it, and I doubt that it will pass. You know, beyond that, I think there's a decent chance they could agree to the universal background check thing. You know, even after, a lot of people forget, but after the Virginia Tech shootings, when you had, George W. Bush in the White House, Congress did, in fact, pass more money and a strengthened background check system. They didn't close the gun show loophole and do some of the more ambitious things we're talking about now. But they did, you know, according to the NRA at least, and I think fairly, they did actually pass, and George W. Bush signed what amounted to a gun control bill. So, you know, I think the support is there among some Republicans. 88% of the public, last poll I saw, supports the universal background checks. So I think there's a pretty fair chance that'll get done.
Yeah. So it's good to be talking about these exciting proposals, or at least seeing some exciting action, because, you know, as we were just discussing, since the 90s, we haven't seen movement like this, although we'll see what actual action ends up happening from Congress. But I've already started to start thinking through if things are brought into law, the kinds of things that Obama has talked about, some of the things that Cuomo put into law in New York, how that gets enforced and what that ends up meaning for, you know, people on the ground. And I've raised a flag, and as has Julianne, our guest, so I'm going to bring her in on this, about what it might mean for people of color. And there was a piece of Obama's proposal that had to do with putting some more guards in schools. So Julianne, do you want to sort of describe that and your take on it?
Sure. Well, you know, so what Obama has called for sounds actually rather benign, and actually quite positive to progressive ears. He wants 1,000 more school psychologists, social workers, counselors, and school resource officers in schools. But school resource officers are just a very very kind euphemism for armed police officers. And you know, and there's a lot of debate, but mostly mixed results on whether or not police and schools actually make schools safer. But you know, we've been here before. Immediately after Columbine, President Clinton authorized $70 million in federal funding to beef up police presence in schools, and so you know that in and of itself is part of a decades-long rise in the militarization of schools. Through, you know, it's not just armed police officers. We're also living in the days of drug-sniffing dogs that are a regular presence in public schools, security cameras, you know, locked gates. So schools are becoming increasingly more like fortresses these days. But immediately after Columbine, you know, Clinton authorized more police in schools. And you know, some of the research that is out there about how much good that has done has shown that, you know, by and large, when police are in schools, what they do is arrest people. That's you know, that's part of their training. And what most police officers in schools are doing, far from, you know, cracking down on very serious violent crime, is actually arresting kids or being part of a school-to-prison pipeline that sends kids out of the school environment and makes it much, much easier for them to have more interaction with the criminal justice system. And this school-to-prison pipeline is a real phenomena, and it has very stark racially disparate outcomes. The Department of Education just released data last year that showed that Black students were roughly in about like 18% of those they sampled. It was a national 2-year study. Black students were 18% of those they sampled, and 35% of those who get suspended, and 39% of those who get expelled. And you see those figures replicated just about, you know, at every layer of granularity, from national to statewide, local. These, you know, what we see is that when there are police in schools, the way that police act in schools is very much the way they police outside of school. They're very, very strong racially disparate outcomes. And so there's a lot of concern that not only do police not make schools safer, but they actually could be aggravating the school-to-prison pipeline, which President Obama has actually, you know, has actually made concrete steps to address. And so there's a conflict there between putting more police in schools with the goal of making them safer environments, and actually what we know about what police in schools does to school environments.
Absolutely. And I also think, you know, as you said, it seems that there's also a likelihood if you arrest a student for a behavior infraction, and some of these are very small. Some of these have to do with uniforms or talking back to teachers. You know, this isn't just because someone comes in and is threatening violence on other students or something extreme like that. You arrest them and you have them come into contact with the criminal justice system. And as you said, they're more likely then to come in contact with it again later in life, which is kind of a nice way of saying we may be creating more crime by what we think we're doing to sort of stop crime in schools. I mean, is that sort of a good way of putting that phenomenon?
Yeah, that's what the research is pointing towards. The sorts of things that would in prior generations have landed kids in the principal's office and then detention are now these days meaning that kids are getting suspended. Some kids are getting expelled. Kids get arrested, and it sounds like it sounds totally nuts. You know, that a fist fight, or that, like you said, you know, talking back to a teacher, showing disrespect. Those things could be arrestable offenses in schools, but it's part of a larger program. You know, zero tolerance policies, they're like the mandatory minimums of the school discipline world, and so there are these harsh and automatic punishments that kick in, and especially because so much of misbehavior is very subjective. That's where we see the racial disproportionality come in, because what we know actually is that Black students, white students, when they get suspended, it's for very objective things like being caught cutting class or graffitiing on campus. But when it's Black students, you know, Black students are far more likely to get suspended for very subjective offenses like being disrespectful or being disruptive. You know, it's super concerning. The school-to-prison pipeline in and of itself is a very urgent issue. And then when we're talking about trying to make schools safer, adding police to the picture, adding more police to the picture, is actually, based on what, you know, experts are finding, counter to what would make a school a safer, more inclusive, more therapeutic environment.
Right. The other thing, too, I mean, obviously this has a disparate racial impact, and it's not all schools that have police officers and security cameras and metal detectors that are in them. What I thought was interesting about Obama's proposal is that it's not sort of mandating it across the board. It's sort of saying, here are resources if you want more guards in your schools. Do you have a sense of what, you know, if that's how it ends up being played out, which schools are going to be the ones that grab that money and which ones decide not to? Do we know how that usually works?
Yeah, I mean, well, so, you know, in terms of what the picture looks like right now, when, you know, cash-strapped school districts and especially school districts in communities of color and poor neighborhoods find that they don't have money for school support staff like nurses and psychologists and social workers, but there tends to be more money around for police officers and school security. And so I think that's more a reflection of the priorities and the assessment about what threats schools are facing. And so I think it sort of remains to be seen how the resources will be distributed and what people will end up going for. But what we know right now is that, you know, there are far more, a majority of students in the U.S. Go to schools now with police officers, and an increasing number of students are going to schools without, with fewer numbers of counselors and nurses and other support staff that fill different roles that police now are increasingly being called on to fill.
It's interesting if you look at the legislation just passed and signed in New York State by Andrew Cuomo. I was reading through the text the other day, and it actually has a similar school security provision, though a little bit stronger than even what Obama's proposing. And what that law says is that basically if schools request security funds from the state government, that the formula is 10% higher basically for what they'll receive, if we're talking about security guards as opposed to any other kind of capital improvement or staff. So that's interesting. But it seems like what you're saying is that, you know, if it ends up that a lot of, on the federal level, that a lot of kind of impoverished school districts end up reaching for this money, well, the obvious point here is that that is not actually where we're seeing any of these school shooting problems happen. I mean, it's just not. It seems inconsistent on that level with the problem that's ostensibly being addressed here. And beyond that, you know, reading a lot about these school shooters, virtually none of them, I want to say none of them actually, were kind of known troublemakers that people thought, well, if only, you know, there had been kind of law enforcement officers watching these guys, that it could have been avoided. I mean, you know, there's a psychological issue. There are some who you can say, well, the school counselor should have known something. But for a lot of these young men, actually, I think all of them, the first time they ever get in trouble is when they start shooting up the school. So in several different ways, it seems like it just kind of flies past the problem that Washington's trying to address anyway.
Yeah, you know, I in a piece I wrote for Color Lines last week, I dug up an old report that the Secret Service did jointly with, I believe, you know, I'd have to check it, but it was a joint Secret Service report immediately after Columbine that evaluated 20 years worth of school-based shootings, and these researchers were able to find no conclusive profile of shooters. They all were male, and most of them were white. But otherwise, you know, none of them actually had exhibited violent behavior. None of them had had, you know, none of them had. Most of them did not have, you know, brushes with the law. But most of them did exhibit issues with, you know, depression. They had difficulty dealing with personal failures or losses in life, and these are the sorts of things, you know, they had exhibited some signs. There were friends and teachers who could tell that maybe they were in need of some help. But you know, when we talk about the role that police officers are there to fill and serve, we may be asking too much of them to identify, you know, a police officer will be there to address an imminent or immediate threat, but, you know, we may be asking too much of police officers to look out for and support and nurture young people who are in need of help that, you know, police officers are not necessarily equipped to provide.
I think also on the issue of providing imminent, you know, and immediate help, I guess that's kind of the best case argument one could make for these. But even then, I think we've seen that doesn't really work. I mean, when Virginia Tech happened, there was an entire well-armed police force on campus that was unable to stop it. There was actually a police officer on duty at Columbine High School unable to stop it. And so even at the, you know, the lowest hanging fruit of what you could say about what these officers could do, I don't think has proven to be all that effective.
Right. And of course, if the police officers are mostly in low income schools that have majority, you know, black kids or brown kids, and are arresting mostly young black men and young black women, but the face of the school shooters is mostly male and white, then they're not even going to be in the right places or be at the right schools where this kind of violence is happening.
Yeah, and you know, I think that we have to think about how we I think violence exists on a spectrum, and these sorts of mass shootings that are so horrific and capture so much of our attention often eclipse a lot of the everyday violence that actually is happening in neighborhoods where there actually are a lot of police already. You know, we just got out of a very bloody year of homicides in Chicago, where youth make up a big part of those who are victims of gun violence. And, you know, some of that stuff happens in and around schools. And so, you know, I think it's important to think about how we respond to these sorts of mass school-based shootings, and also what we're doing or not doing to address the kind of everyday violence that's happening in communities of color that deal with a lot of violence spread out all year long.
Well, I think we will wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Julianne, for joining us. And thanks, George, for co-hosting as always. You can find more about this topic at thenation.com, and you can find all of Julianne's writing at colorlines.com. And please join us next week for another episode of the podcast.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.